Kreisky Forum Talks, der Podcast zur Stunde.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, all of you, for being here. It's really a great honor to be addressing you. And it's very pleasing to see that we have a very distinguished and rather large audience, given the size of this room and given the constraints on discussions of issues relating to the Middle East, which have just been evoked by Nadia. Thank you very much, Gertrud, for all your help over the years and for your cooperation, which has been unflappable, gracious, and unstinting. And we're really truly grateful to you. And I'm also grateful to all our postdocs that we've had over the years, who have actually made this program, this research program. They did all the work. This is not my expertise, it's not Nadia's expertise, but there were a number of issues which we thought we would like to be thought about in particular ways, in ways which are not very much which are not as current as they ought to be. There's quite a lot of fabulation about the Middle East, so we thought we'd need to do something else. And I think we, to a certain, to an appreciable extent, we have done this, again, thanks to yet another institution, which is the Carnegie Corporation. Thank you very much, Hillary, for all your support. Now, let me move to another key altogether. This evening's event is particularly congenial, at least for me personally. It's even a warm setting. First of all, we have two extremely distinguished speakers who are compatriots and whom I dare to call friends as well. But we're also talking under the signature of the genius loci presiding over this space, over this venue. And I mean, of course, the example of Bruno Kreisky. A man of singular wisdom, sense of justice, powers of persuasion, who had set, in my view, the gold standard for European dealings with the Arab world, and most specifically with the question of Palestine. Yasser Arafat was hosted in this villa at one point. Now, Kreisky's example has unfortunately been largely spurned, ignored, and we will see the consequences. Kreisky had tried to give the issue of Palestine its due political and moral weight. Most have preferred to pretend it did not exist, or resorted to oblivion as a means of erasure, or to self-righteous and self-absorbed indifference. We know today how wrong they are, and how right he was, and we know that the issue is ineradicable. Now, having said this as an attempt to bring a number of things together. And before I give you a little bit of further context and I ask our speakers a couple of questions, I would like to introduce them. Now, Tariq Mitri and Ghassan Salami are, if I dare say that, past masters and present masters as well. Across worlds that span our interests this evening, they observe, they understand, and they practice. They have involvements, and they have intellectual involvements as well, quite apart from their practical work. Both have served in government. Both have served it as international statesmen. Both are ranking Arab intellectuals, and both have run major academic institutions. So really, no way we could have done any better in our choice of speakers. Tariq Mitri studied originally at the American University of Beirut and at Paris Nanterre. He is the president of St. George's University in Beirut. After many years of work in the World Council of Churches, he ran the Hassan Faris Center for Public Policy and International Affairs and held many government positions. Here in Lebanon. He was Minister of the Environment, Minister of Information, Minister of Culture, Minister of Foreign Affairs. And he was one of those who had been besieged and cloistered in Government House in Beirut, as I do remember very well, at a time after Hezbollah crowds had taken over the center of Beirut and besieged that particular government house. And of course, Tariq Mitri served as the UN Special Representative for Libya, on which he wrote a very interesting book of his experiences, entitled Masalik Wa'ira, Rough Terrain, Rough Pathways, whatever you might like to call it. In addition to other books, Christians in the Arab World, in Arab Politics, Reclaiming a Pact of Citizenship, Medina ala Jabal, Au nom de Bible, which is a book about religion and politics in the United States, available incidentally in German translation, and quite a number of other works. He is chair of the Sursok Museum in Beirut. He is member of the board of management of the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies in Doha. And particularly pertinent tonight, he is the chair of the board of trustees of the Institute for Palestine Studies. And if I might just give you a very brief idea, this is an institution which was established in 1963. It holds books, produces journals in two languages. There used to be three at one point. It has fellowships, documents, events, studies. And it is the most reliable source of information on Palestine anywhere. This is particularly pertinent today as we are seeing all manner of pressure to curtail any work on that particular issue. So if you want to know about Palestine, look up the website of the IPS, and at any price, avoid the German press. The production of knowledge on that particular issue, incidentally, is the main task of the Institute of Palestine Studies. And we have now also, and I must mention this because it is pertinent, the Palestine Studies Forum, which meets annually at the Arab Center in Doha, and which is a forum in which academics from all over the world and some politicians come to discuss research about all aspects of Palestine, be they political, anthropological, art, music, folklore, the whole lot. So thank you very much for being with us tonight, Tariq, and I'm really looking forward to what you are going to say to us about this and other matters that that are on the table. Ghassan Salami, also studied in Beirut, studied at Sciences Po. His initial interests were in theater and literature and so forth. And I can tell you his interest in the arts has not waned. He is still the chairman of the Arab Fund for Arts and Culture. He has had academic engagements over the years with Sciences Po, with IFRI in Paris, the American University of Beirut, and Saint Joseph in Beirut as well, and stints at Harvard and Columbia, like Tariq Mitri as well. In 2010, he established and acted as the founding dean of the Paris School of Public Affairs at Sciences Po, and I must claim, Hassan, a certain share in your glory, because I had the privilege of being invited to be the to deliver the first lecture at the opening of the of PSEA in September, I think, or October 2010. He's been political advisor to the UN mission in Iraq right after the Iraq invasion, right after the invasion, and miraculously survived the 2003 explosion that killed the UN Special Representative, Sergio Di Mello. He's been special advisor to the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan. And then he was, of course, also UN Special Envoy and Special Representative in Libya. He served as Minister in Culture in Lebanon. I do remember also that he had been asked to organize the Arab Summit of 2002, which produced the Arab Peace Initiative, which again, like the ideas and memories of Bruno Kreisky, had been spurned or forgotten or disregarded. I will mention only the last of Ghassan Salami's books, which is actually published today. it's on war and peace in these ages. La tentation de Mars, the temptation of Mars, and the temptations of war and the problems of achieving peace in a world where war is taking the upper hand in a number of domains. Now, finally, just a couple of preliminary remarks. Now, you may be intrigued by the title Spoils of War. Spoils of War was actually motivated by the realization that the post-war conditions that exist in Syria and Iraq are really have churned out dynamics of conflict in suspended animation. It's a kind of interregnum. It's a set of newly vested interests, each of which are trying to establish polities, exercising forms of social engineering, conducting themselves according to business models, which are reminiscent of business models that animate quite a number of militias, be it in the Congo or in Latin America. And our collaborators have studied the consequences of the evisceration of bodies social and of bodies political, demographic engineering, including demographic engineering in Gaza today, which needs to be taken as part of the package. All of this, and the fact that the region has become a space for proxy wars, makes it very difficult to understand, makes it very difficult to apply any categories, any normal categories of the understanding of conflict of this kind. We have tried to develop special vocabularies. I won't put them before you now, but this prompts me simply to pose a couple of very simple questions to our speakers. Not questions necessarily to be answered, but simply as triggers of further reflection. First of all, are there any keys that one might be able to identify in order to facilitate understanding and allow at least minimal unraveling and a minimal amount of prediction of the overall situation in the region? Second question, the idea of a second Nakba, you're all familiar with the term Nakba, of a second Nakba has been very much in circulation. Now, the first, the devastation of Palestine in 1948 triggered a number of very significant changes in the region. Now, my second question is whether what's happening now will actually trigger changes of more or less the same order, which, if that were to be the case, might bring the Arab world back in again. And thank you. Over to you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased and honored indeed to be hosted by the Bruno Kreisky Dialogue Forum. And I'm equally pleased to be a witness to the concluding event of a very interesting project that Professor Al-Azmi and Professor Baghdadi have been leading for the last few years. I had the privilege to host them in Beirut. I had a modest role just to introduce you, as you did today. I learned a lot from the good work that was accomplished. I'm going to talk about Gaza first, and then the rest will follow through. The people of Gaza are victims of war crimes. Crimes against humanity and actions falling under the Genocide Convention as deemed plausible by the International Court of Justice, enough to issue interim orders or provisional measures. Concurrently, we witness escalating attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank by settlers enjoying the support of the Israeli military and security services, whether through turning a blind eye, collision, or direct involvement. Mild moral and political pressures continue to fall short of stopping the aggression and imposing a ceasefire. However, we hear a lot about the future, about what comes after Gaza, and about the political process that will be launched at the end of the war. We hear about vague intentions of the United States of America, their new promise, the so-called two-state solution, or the revival of old promises that have not materialized, might serve, in the eyes of the Americans, as an incentive for a putative normalization with Arab countries. However, it should have become clearer that the conflict over Palestine is no longer a low-intensity dispute that Arab countries and influential Western countries considered secondary or important but not urgent, as Kissinger used to say. The Palestinian cause has regained its vitality at the heart of Arab and international realities. In Israel, we have seen the society united, hardly affording to tolerate dissenting opinions. The instinct for revenge and insistence on punishing the Palestinians dominated since the atrocities of October the 7th. One has good reasons to argue that the settler mentality has never accepted the presence of those who remain on their land, or any part of historical Palestine, for that matter. The occupier does not accept any violence manifested by the occupied indigenous, especially when they commit cruel and indiscriminate acts, such as they did on October 7th. Whether true, exaggerated, or invented by the Zaka organization, such extreme violence is retaliated with collective punishment. Primarily, occupation relies on violence. Any delay in its exercise leads to fears within settler society, forcing the state to use violence exponentially. All energies are mobilized to face what they see or made to see as an existential threat. Revenge is not, I call it self-defense, revenge is not exercised to satisfy the pride of the occupiers and their sense of superiority, but rather to teach the Palestinians and their neighbors an unforgettable lesson. All practices are permissible, including the invocation of the tragic memory of the Holocaust. There are cases where Israeli soldiers were heard on their way to Gaza saying that they felt that they were entering Auschwitz to fight the Nazis. Thus, insulting not only their own victims, but also the victims of Nazism. The war on Gaza reiterated what the siege of Beirut in 1982, the blockade in Ramallah 2004, the war on Lebanon in 2006, and the successive wars on Gaza, which had previously revealed that the Palestinian issue is an issue of every Arab state individually. Some countries are more affected, like my own, Lebanon, than others. Palestinians hope that expressions of solidarity have become a ferment for the future. They know fairly well that it does not immediately change the behavior of governments who are tied each in a different way and for different reasons to a web of regional international relations, even if they are compelled to align with popular sympathy for Palestinians. I'm talking about Arab regimes. It is obvious that major powers have diverse interests and inclinations in our region, and Israel is considered by international powers as a stable ally and a formidable military force. However, if Arab governments were to respond to the will of their people, even for reasons unrelated to Palestine, they could stand in contradiction with Israel's vision for the future of the region. Israel's friendship could then become a burden on the major countries in the region. Many polls indicate that the Arab public opinion is strongly opposed to normalization with Israel. This opposition may not necessarily yield significant political changes, but it remains true that the plight of Gaza and the Palestinian cause seem to hold the region together, at least emotionally. Arab responses to the war could not, and perhaps will not, ignore neither popular anger nor the risks of resurgent extremism. Palestine has become more significant in how many Arab countries perceive their national interests. This does not mean that there will be more regional unity and a shared resolve, but resurfacing necessities could bring to the forefront a sense of regional security and hope for dynamics that could turn present-day rivals into neighbors. This may come true not only for Arab countries, but also for Iran and for Turkey. Iran has progressed in the path of normalization with Saudi Arabia, while positioning itself as an interlocutor and even a partner of the US in a joint effort to avoid the full regionalization of the war on Gaza. Turkey is equally mending relations with Arab countries that hitherto saw themselves destabilized by its reputed and feared support to mainstream Islamists. Today, many rulers may have become less likely to project their insecurities on the design of their regional rivals. But the question remains whether this emerging reality could stop proxy wars or limit their effects and allow consequently, a few countries, such as mine, Lebanon, to suffer less from having been for many, many years battlegrounds for regional conflicts. Not too long ago, debates about political order, whether national or regional, centered around the role of Islamists striking from the margin, democratization, and issues of governance. In the case of countries that were supposed to be transitioning into a new order, mediations between factions and attempts at power sharing arrangements prevailed over state building or rebuilding. Today, Islamists of all shades are weaker, and so are states, even if ruled by authoritarian regimes. There is a veneer of stability valued by conservatives who are inclined to think that the page of 2011 uprisings have been irreversibly turned. To be sure, the political and socio-economic grievances that fueled protests and revolutions persist, and in many instances have gotten only worse. Populations have swelled, inequalities deepened, violations of basic rights amplified, and corruption expanded. 14 years ago, Arab uprisings initiated in an unanticipated manner transformations in a region that seemed resistant to change. Expectations and hopes energized a large number of people, whether young or not so young. Today's disappointment, though understandable, is often engineered. It serves the purpose of justifying attempts to reverse transitions, whatever that means, divert their courses, and withdraw into defensive and regressive identity politics. Precarious national structures and the related fragility of national cohesion, exacerbated further by the rapid and unforeseen collapse of the old order, favored a tendency to overemphasize the strength of the so-called primordial ties. In contrast with the enfeebling of civic ties that are constitutive of a modern democratic society, one could not ignore the resurgence or the reinvention of sub-national identities and the centrifugal forces at work in many countries, in the Arab Mashriq, but beyond, in Libya, to name a country that Ghassan and I have diligently served. There are situations where members of communities seem to have lost their aspiration to a state for all. Some beg for a power structure that can protect them from another community. Weakened states and political strategies of mobilization have accentuated communalism in the Arab Mashriq, at least, and encouraged the surfacing of narratives of victimhood, often emotional, but also aggressive, for victims can be aggressive. Many leaders across the region do little more than tap into the use of persecution felt by communities without offering them alternatives to fear and uncertainty. Many members of the majority are victims, but ethnic and religious minorities claim extraordinary victimhood. The very conflicts that undermine what is left of the state become, for many rulers of the region, a source of legitimacy, a cause for further entrenching and a distraction from addressing problems that they are not capable or unwilling to solve, such as in Syria, Iraq, but also Libya and Yemen. It is not, therefore, a surprise to see violence becoming a policy by default. Ethnic groups, and ethnicized religious groups are both actors and victims of identity politics. Throughout the 20th century, their members struggled to assert themselves and be recognized as citizens. But many retreated and became minority-centered communities, enclaved whenever possible. Transition from authoritarian regimes to democracy has proved to be more arduous than anticipated. Today, the social demand for security and stability in a context of a bloody disorder is interpreted, like in the case of Egypt, as a demand for a return to the authoritarian rule. But it is not. Repression is far less tolerated than before. The call for political participation cannot be silenced. The legacy of authoritarian regimes weighs heavily on political conduct, and the management of transition nurtures suspicions and mutual fears, majorities and minorities alike. Rebuilding state institutions left in desolation is severely hindered. The shortfalls of transition could not be overstated. The deficit in competence and experience of large segments of the new political elites, the weakness of political forces with a social base attached to democratic values, all of those may explain the volatility of state building in our region. Progress on this road towards democratic transformation could not be achieved by adopting a presumably universal model of transition. A paradigm for political change must be better suited for the realities of today, not the lingering memory of an earlier era. In other words, the seemingly stronger propensity today to perceive social realities in subnational communal terms in a mode of self-assertion for some, or that of withdrawal from public life for others, was implicitly criticized for failing to offer a way out of the present crisis. In some cases, much of the communal identity politics tends to respond to a conscious and unavowed marginalization with an unintended self-marginalization. Communalism, in the Mashriq mostly, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, often called sectarianism or confessionalism, appears to have become entrenched in the social, cultural, and political life of those countries, more particularly the ones I've mentioned. Warning against the pitfall of communal identity politics has not been well received by some, and it will continue to be rejected, in my understanding, until its proponents, whether in Iraq, Syria, or Lebanon, realize that they have attained or they are about to attain a dead end. Moreover, any attempt at offering a credible alternative to pursuing such identity politics is not an easy task, especially if perceived not only as unrealistic, but as costly. Exacerbated communalism is no remedy to the sense of victimhood. It is no remedy to worries and fears. More often than not, it aggravates them. But for those who are not gripped with a sense of fatality, hesitations and questions can provide a fertile breeding ground for new prospective ideas. Should we hope that times of uncertainty and anxiety be times of change. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. This is really much food for thought, and I find a number of very fertile ideas that we might be able to explore. I particularly like the expression extraordinary victimhood, right? A kind of enhancement which then becomes in many ways incommensurable, but that's a different story altogether. This is a personal comment about a preference to a term you used. Issues of communalism, issues of the interfaces between the issue of Palestine as a kind of metonym or as a symbol of a wider Arab commonality, political commonality, national commonality, coexisting at the same time with a trend towards the communalization that you mentioned, the generation of sub-state polities, as it were, which are really the locus of the spoils of war and of the vested interests, which are these are, I think, extremely important issues which we might like to. We might like to take up later, maybe in a little bit more detail. May I ask you to come in now, Hassan, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Aziz. So the story goes that two Scotsmen has a bet. Who is going to put the smallest piece of money in the basket that is circulating in the church? So the first one took the smallest and put it in the basket. And he looked at his friend, and he said, "What are you going to do?" And the friend said, "He paid for both of us." So, Tariq spoke also for me, mainly on two issues. One, on the debauchery, unprecedented debauchery of violence in Gaza. I have spent summer 1982 together with Tariq in West Beirut. We have seen a lot of violence before and after Sabra and Shatila, and certainly during Sabra and Shatila. But this level of violence, I have never seen. Even during the period of time I spent with the Rohingya in Myanmar, where violence is almost unbearable. What we are seeing in Gaza is almost a word apex of dehumanization and blind violence. I mean, 10,000 kids, this is not common in any war. And it is all the more so that what we are witnessing, and of course, the second point on which Tariq spoke for me is also on communalism, but to this I'll come back. Aziz has asked us two basic questions. One I will hold for the moment, probably for another part of the discussion, but I will try to answer the first. What are the keys to understand better what you have been studying in the past 5 years in terms of civil wars in the Middle East and the Arab Mashriq and the after crisis of this? And I am going to propose two or three ideas, both from my experience as a scholar and as a practitioner. And the first of one is a bit provocative. It is to say that we are in an era in which the Middle East, to a large extent, is not an exception, but is sort of an alarm for the rest of the world, as it has been many times in the past. We are in an era where all wars are more or less civil. In what sense? If you look at these statistics, most of the victims in all conflicts today are civil. I'm not going to talk about Sudan, where 6 million people have been displaced, civilians, and so many of them killed. I'm not going to talk about other conflicts in Congo, for example, and elsewhere. So the fact that civilians are killed in Gaza is somehow not an exception. What is exceptional is something I'll go back to in Gaza. It is that civilians are not killed by accident or as a collateral damage. They are the targeted. They are targeted as such, as civilians, as kids, as women, etc. But I was saying that all wars are becoming civil. Because for a long, long time, we looked at war the way we look at Greek tragedies. That is something that is contained in space, contained in time, and contained in the number of players in that drama. That's how we depicted Greek tragedy. And that's how Clausewitz, among others, depicts war as something contained. You can define the time of the war. There is a big difference between the time of peace and the time of war. A war starts with a declaration of war and ends with a ceasefire or with a truce. You can define also the space of the war. There is a war taking place in that part, and the rest of the country and the other countries are not touched by the war. The war has a place. It's called, call it Waterloo or Jena or whatever. It has a place. And the number of players were also known, because there was a basic definition, a basic difference between combatants and non-combatants. So those who were combatants had a khaki, and they were paid to go and fight. And the non-combatants were in the back, and they were not part of the story. So war, like a Greek tragedy, was contained in space, contained in time, and contained in the victims and the targets and the players in that drama. Look at the wars today. Even in what looks like a classical war in Ukraine, civilians are playing a very important role. On the one hand, Putin is mobilizing big time civilians and compelling them to go and fight in the war. But also civilians on both sides, especially on the Ukrainian side, are playing a very important role with their smartphone, with their primitive drones, etc. So the difference between, although there are fewer civilian victims in that conflict, but still civilians are part of the story. And it's a state of war. It has been a state of war since the first invasion of Ukraine in 2014. Look at other civil wars. What we are seeing in Sudan today is an incredibly violent civil war that has no end in sight and that has affected most of the population. What we have seen recently in Nagorno-Karabakh is the complete ethnic cleansing of a province into some other place. The 140,000 of them. So civilians are targeted, civilians are part of the story, and the war has no clear beginning, no clear end. We are at an era where the state of war is becoming the natural order of things for many countries. In fact, nowadays, recently Pryo in Norway has enumerated 145 conflicts underway only in sub-Saharan Africa, which means that you have provinces, sometimes whole countries, living in a state of war as a natural state of things. So we Lebanese, we know that when we say there was a civil war in Lebanon between 1975 and 1989, that it doesn't mean a daily fighting for 15 years. You have truce, you have period of quasi-peace, etc. But the state of war was becoming the natural order of things. So I believe that we need to go that step further in our study of what is happening, say, in Syria. In Syria, war is becoming the natural order of things. And when I say war, I am talking also about the appendices of the civil war. that is a civil war economy with new entrepreneurs making huge amounts of money at the expense of the population, with a complete collapse of public services, both in the government-run areas and the opposition, and also the use of natural resources, in the case of Syria, of oil, in the fighting, in the competition for power taking place there. So with time, this kind of dynamics produces players who have no interest whatsoever at thinking of peace, of civil peace. Therefore, for them, the perpetuation of this state of affairs becomes an objective in itself. And I do believe that there are today between 40 and 50 countries in the world where this is happening. And Syria is not an exception. In fact, it is a pioneering case people should look at in order to understand what could happen in many other countries in the world. The second point I would like to add to your, the second key, if you want, you are asking for, is this concept that comes in your literature about proxy war. I have stopped using that expression. I think that proxy war is an easy thing. This is for the lazy people. Journalists and politicians, when you talk about any conflict in the world, start by asking you, who's interfering in that war? Ah, the US, Russia, France, etc. And they are content with that. Okay, but is this dynamic of interference really playing a central, a pivotal role in that war? I think we are witnessing nowadays something that was not there 20 or 30 years ago, a complete laziness to go and study the domestic players and their strategies and their ability to implicate foreign interference to their own advantage, manipulating their donors rather than being manipulated by them. And this is something I saw in Lebanon, I saw in Iraq, I saw in Libya, I saw in so many other places, where the domestic players play a much bigger role than usually assumed by journalists or by analysts or by politicians. Therefore, I don't believe that the concept of proxy war is really useful. I will add something else, in fact. I would say that the concept of proxy war has a flavor of racism in it, because it comes with the idea that foreign capitals can manipulate at their ease domestic dynamics as much as they want, and that basically the local players are only instruments in the hand of the civilized countries of the world. I believe these are good reasons, two good reasons, to have some doubts about that concept. The third key I would like to put on your table, Aziz, since you asked for keys, is the problem of identity that is already being mentioned by Tariq. We who come from plural societies, sociological plural societies, have always had a big reservations about the primordialist line of thinking about identity. And rightly so. Primordialism basically means that civil wars are there on identity cleavages now and forever, because they have existed since the beginning of times. And they have, there are primordialist well-known gurus, Robert Kaplan and Rebecca West and Clifford Geertz and so many other anthropologists. We know that this is not enough to understand what is happening. We know that sometimes these ancient hatreds have been constructed afterwards. And we know they didn't exist. And we are certain that there were periods of time that they did not exist. In our own lifetime, we know that. That there were long eras, long decades of conviviality, etc. That, and of course, the natural solution or remedy to reading a civil war with the eye of a primordialist is to say, well, the best thing is to give war a chance. That's what Robert Ludwig wrote in a famous essay once. Give war a chance. And what you can do, really, is partition the country and help in the ethnic cleansing. Instead of doing it under the bayonet, take air-conditioned buses and move the population somewhere else. Well, the Israelis have been trying to do exactly that in Gaza, were it not for the strong reaction they encountered. And it is still a possibility, unfortunately, to do some kind of ethnic cleansing. So primordialism is not very popular among reasonable people, but it is popular in the public opinion. It is popular in the public opinion. And when you discuss primordialism with the man in the street, he will tell you, look, my friend, Lebanon has been created in the year 1920, but Shiism and Sunnism have been around for 14 centuries. So don't tell me that primordialism doesn't exist. This is too intellectual a position. One key is our failure to defend a critique or to present a critique of primordialism that is acceptable not only to our colleagues, but also to the man in the street, who strongly believes that primordialism is the... Studies on Africa have been much better than studies on the Middle East when it comes to the second school in reading civil wars, that is instrumentalism. They have criticized primordialism, and they have offered studies of civil war entrepreneurs who use the civil war in order to enrich themselves. And studies on warlordism in Africa has been much more developed than study on warlordism in our part of the world. Although the warlords in Lebanon are known, their names are in the press every day, we don't study them. Recently, something of that kind happened in Iraq big time, big time. Warlordism is now dominating Iraq. But I think that and warlordism is certainly a very vital part of the Libyan conflict, to talk about three conflicts I have been familiar with. I think this is a very important key. If we want to fight primordialism, you need to sort of amplify or to illustrate your study of instrumentalism as an approach. The third school is very important. It has been very, very well used in the study of Russia after 1990, but not so much of the Middle East. It is institutionalism. It is the fact to see how, during the transitions, institutions have been taken over by those who worked in them. And that explains, to a large extent, the huge amount of nepotism that took place under Yeltsin in the years 1990. Well, institutionalism in our part of the world has been a poor relative in our reading of the Civil War. And finally, the fourth school, constructivism, is the one we were interested in. But for that, we need to be pluridisciplinary and to bring psychologists and anthropologists into the story. So the second key I have is that the various schools are useful, that the terrain of the Middle East is very fertile for us, but that we need to be much more active in fighting against primordialism, because primordialism is very pessimistic view of human nature. It means basically that people want to kill each other the minute they are allowed to do, and that alterity necessarily means conflictuality. And this is not true, we know that, and if we accept that, it is the end of what we can do. Do we still have a moment towards? Okay. Then comes a fourth key I would like to put on the table. That's the key of sovereignty. But before going into sovereignty, let me say something about Gaza here, because it has to do, to a large extent, the war in Gaza can be read as a civil war. In fact, the Arab-Israeli conflict, or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, is one from an intellectual point of view. If I put aside my emotional and my intellectual interest and I go into an objective, somehow, intellectual point of view, you'll see that this conflict is very, very interesting in the sense that it has been multiform in its evolution. In 1936, what you have witnessed was a kind of small civil war between the Palestinian population, the locals, the natives, would say a colonial, and the settlers who came to try and steal the land and basically move out the population. It was a civil war. There was some kind of support, very little support from here and there, but basically the Palestinians were in their own. That was a Palestinian thing. Then, in 1948, started a new era, completely different. We went out of the civil war, the Palestinians were marginalized, and we had four regular armies conflict. We are far from the civil war paradigm. In 1967, in 1956, in 1948, in 1956, in 1967, and then in 1973, that is 50 years ago. 50 years ago, the Arab-Israeli conflict ended 50 years ago. That was the last regular army confrontation between Israel and the Arab world. In the meanwhile, something else happened. We became a local reflection, a regional reflection of the international competition between the two blocs. And in 1967 and 1973, we had nuclear alarms in the United States and in the Soviet Union of 3 out of 5 degrees. That is a very high level of nuclear alert. Remember that day when Brezhnev called for the first time, and then in 1973, and called the second time, and immediately Nixon and Kissinger decided a nuclear alert, and the Soviet Union did the same after the crossing of the canal. But after 1973, it was over. Long before Camp David, it was over. The regional part disappeared, the international conflict disappeared in 1990, so its local reflection disappeared as well. To a large extent, we are back to 1936, to a civil war paradigm. And in this civil war, there is a very strong player and a very weak player, a very illegitimate player and a very legitimate one. And the difference between legitimacy and power is just mind-boggling, mind-boggling. Finally, I would say a word about sovereignty. The dream of the two states is the idea that the Palestinians have a sovereign entity of their own. I have good news and bad news about that. Let me start with the bad news. I don't know many sovereign countries in the world right now. My country is certainly not a sovereign one. Those who think that Lebanon is a sovereign country haven't visited the country for a long time. I would say that dozens of countries in the world cannot pretend to be sovereign. In the three definitions of sovereignty, the definition of sovereignty as your control over your territory, your borders, that is the domestic sovereignty. The fact that in that territory, There is no competition to the state authority from other centers of authority. And sovereignty, the second definition of sovereignty, the Westphalian sovereignty, the idea that you can have the regime you want in your own country and that other countries cannot impose their regime or their religion upon you. And three, the international. That is, you are as sovereign as all the other countries in the world. You are the, you have your flag on the First Avenue in New York. Well, if you take these three conditions of sovereignty, a lot of countries are not sovereign today. So I tend to pose on the table that if we are able to produce a Palestinian state, which is my hope, something for which I have fought for 60 years of my life, it will not be a sovereign country. It will be like so many other countries in the world that lack sovereignty. Therefore, I think we are coming to a period of time where, although my grandson can see the different countries in the world on a world map, in fact, one of them is obsessed with a world map with sovereign countries, it's too formal to be true. It's too formal to be true. So we are fighting for something, and we should keep fighting for that thing, but we should be extremely aware that when a Palestine exists as a sovereign state, it will not be more sovereign than Lebanon or Jordan or Syria or other countries in the Middle East. Thank you.